Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the forthcoming presidential elections in Cameroon, slated for October this year. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Jude Mutai. Dr. Mutai is an adjunct professor at San Diego State University in the United States and Program Officer, Africa National Endowment for Democracy. He's also the founder and CEO of the Mutai Foundation that has been in operation and existence since 2011. Jude, it is my pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you so much. I'm truly delighted to be with you this morning.
Brilliant. So let's start off. So, come October 2025, there's going to be a presidential election in Cameroon. It looks like this particular election, it looks like the stake is very, very high.
It is.
In this particular election. So tell me why this particular election is important to Cameroon.
Well, yeah. Again, thank you so much for having me for this conversation. Yes, like you said, Cameroon is looking forward to a very, very crucial election towards the end of this year. That should be in a few months. It's supposed to be in October, although the date has not been announced yet. But, you know, elections are supposed to hold, so we are looking forward to it. It is a very crucial election for many reasons. Of course, as you know, Cameroon has been ruled by a single leader for about 40 years now, 42 years. And for those of us that were born after 1982 or so, we've known just one president. But very importantly, these elections are coming at a time when the incumbent himself is of age. He's 92 years old. He's been there for 42 years without so much to show for. And for a country that has seen huge political apathy for a very long time, especially among young people that make up about 60 to 70% of the population, there is some interest. People are beginning to ask, what is the future of Cameroon without any clear succession plan? People are beginning to ask, what is the future of this country, especially as, you know, Cameroon has really struggled with some internal issues in recent years. You would also understand that, you know, Biya has built a system that is centered on his personality, you know. Talk about Cameroon, you're talking about Cameroon government, you're talking about the CPDM party, Obia himself. But people are beginning to ask, what happens next? And October is very crucial. Again, he's really of age, advanced, respect him for that. But you know, at that age, people are beginning to think it's probably time for him to rest and let someone else take over. But also, you still have people within his camp that still want him to continue. So it's a very crucial election as far as the future of the politics of Cameroon is concerned.
So we'll come to what happens next, because what happens next depends on who wins in the election. So who are the actors vying? Who are the actors that are contesting against Paul Biya with his CPD and party? And what are their prospects? What are the main factors? What are the prospects?
Well, as of now, Biya himself has not declared that he would run. But again, as his party militants have said, and perhaps the rules governing the party, he is the natural candidate. So we expect that he would run, and if he runs, he would definitely win, if you understand Cameroon politics and what people are saying. As far as those contesting against him, Cameroon has a very, very weak and fractured opposition. Of course, we have individuals like Maurice Kamto, for example, who still claim he won the 2018 election. You know, he's been putting forward some really, you know, strong campaigns and getting ready to challenge Biya. But he's also constrained on many fronts. Legally, he was legally. Let me start with the legal aspect of it. For example, legally to contest for Cameroon election, the party must have a representation in parliament. Maurice Kamto in 2020 decided to boycott the legislative elections. According to him, the field was not level for everyone to participate. He was advocating for some serious electoral reforms. And what that did to him was that this year, there was supposed to be another legislative election in January, or I think earlier this year, that would have enabled him to maybe secure one or two representation and then qualify his party to run for elections. But you know, Cameroon being what it is, the government postponed that election and pushed it forward to next year. So, that disqualifies him somehow. But he's been campaigning. He's been able to garner a lot of strong grassroots support, especially among young people in urban areas. He was recently in France, you know, poor heavy crowd. So he's working on it. We don't know. I'm sure he has a plan B, but we don't know that yet.
So that is go on.
That is it for Maurice Kamto. But apart from that, we still have the SDF party of Nijon Fundi. He passed away, but someone else is running that now. Joshua Osi. Then there is also Akeremuna. Akeremuna is really campaigning on the platform of anti-corruption and trying to engage the diaspora. Right this morning, he's really campaigning on the platform of, you know, legalizing dual citizenship in Cameroon, which we don't have at the moment. Yes. These opposition parties are divided. It's very, very important that for them to challenge Biya successfully, they must keep aside their ideological differences. They must keep aside their ego. They must be able reconcile every differences that they have to put a strong foot against Biya. Otherwise, that is going to continue.
Okay. We'll come to the constitutional theatrics. Again, looking at how that theatrics played a role, was in 2018 or 2008 with the removal of the presidential limit. So we say anything can be possible when it comes to that. But we'll come to that and how CPDM had captured the judiciary and the electoral body. But what I want to talk about is what you've mentioned about how the opposition have to be unified. And that also does that also speak to Cameroon's process where it is not the majority that wins. It's a single, how do you do it? It has to be, is it the majority that wins or the one that has said? So speaking of that, I've read somewhere that Maurice Kamto has gained the support of other kind of parties that are forming a coalition how true is that, and how effective is that going to be in the challenge towards Paul Pierce?
You know, yes, he was able to put together a coalition, an alliance of several smaller parties that came together to put him forward as the candidate. But again, you know, Cameroon, the current regime or the current government, you know, has strong control over the legal system, the judiciary, the constitution, in fact, over all the key institutions. And what they basically did was banned all coalitions and classified them as illegal and clandestine institutions. So that had to push Maurice Kamto's coalition of what he was trying to build underground. And, you know, that has kind of, in fact, if coalition is banned, that kind of affect, you know, all the other opposition parties. But I think they can still find ways to come together to
I will come to that in a minute. You mentioned something about the population of Cameroon, whereby over 60% are population under age of 25. So what we're beginning to see, even across Africa, we've seen it in Mozambique, we saw it in Botswana, we're seeing where the youth that are going to have far removed from that anti-colonial narrative. So they have a different kind of political consciousness or drivers. Mm-hmm. And where you see in the Sahel, where you see, you know, some kind of populism or popular uprising against authorities and stuff like that. So now, speaking of that, there's another candidate, because you look at all these candidates, Maurice Kamto, you mentioned Akere Muna, all these people are over 70. And again, fine, there's a massive difference in it between them and Paul Biya, but they're still over 70. You're still talking about old men. So I think there's another candidate that is in his 40s. And again, if you're looking at examples from Senegal with the young president in Senegal and the youth in the military junta in Burkina Faso, it looks like the youth. So how do you see the youth playing a role in this election? Do you see them playing an important role?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, before now, there have been huge political apathy among young people who basically believe that their vote wouldn't count. And so they're just not interested. Some are just, you know, dissatisfied with the failed promises of the administration. They're like, no, we don't have anything to do with this government, right? We should focus on if we can go to school, we go to school. If we can make ends meet, we do get food and eat. And, you know, a lot of young people are just thinking about leaving the country after school. You know, but for those that are there now, I mean, I think the youth, they have a very, very important role to play. But it would really take someone to, you know, to motivate them, to let them know that, look, you have a stake in this. And we have seen that happening during this time in around this election period. We have seen civil society organizations that are led by young people really conducting, you know, civic education, mobilizing people to vote, engaging the elections commission, ELECAM, as it's called in Cameroon, to register more people to vote. You know, so there is some interest here and there. But again, I think to sustain that interest, you have to demonstrate to these young people that the process would be fair, it would be credible, their votes will count, and they can meaningfully participate in the electoral, you know, democratic process of the country. So the youth have a huge role to play, but they need someone to they need that motivation.
So let's create a scenario. Let's say, you know, let's just create a scenario that 2025 October is going to mark a post Paul Biya Kabila regime. So what's going to be, who's going to be the successor? because you know there's been so let's say he decides not to run, or eventually whether he decides to run or not, you know, age is we catch up on every one of us, and whether naturally, you know, let's say naturally, we definitely can't live forever, you know. So what does Paul Biya's, you know, system looks like? What would it look like? Who are the successors? Is there any succession plan?
Well, I don't know if I would say there is a succession plan. There is the constitution, and the constitution basically says, in the case of incapacitation or absence of the president, the president of the Senate takes over, and you know, he is required to hold elections between 120 days. He himself is not allowed to run. But the current situation of Cameroon is that the president of the Senate himself, Masenyat Nifenji, as they call him, is 90 years old, and he's even frail, you know, looks very weak than Paul Biya. So I'm not sure if anything happens to Paul Biya, he has the capacity to even organize an election within that period. So that is the challenge we have there. But, you know, if he is able to do it, then it creates a space for maybe people to see that, oh, we should support an opposition candidate to ensure a transfer of power. But in the absence of that, you know, Cameroon is at a difficult stage, and people have talked about dynastic rule. And many names are featured. Biya's son, of course, Frank Biya, has been mentioned many times. Although, you know, no one really knows Frank Biya. I've never heard his voice. You know, I've seen him shown up at one or two occasions with his dad, but he never says nothing. He's not engaged in the politics of Cameroon. You know, I don't know. I don't think he's even interested. Yeah, his name has come up several times. There are others too within the regime, you know, the current secretary, the presidency, Ferdinand Gongo. They're talking about some are mentioning the current prime minister, Dr. Dion Guti. You know, there's Philomon, who is currently the chairman of the United Nations General Assembly. So many names have future. So the future of Cameroon after Biya, it's really, really hard to tell. If we want to go by the constitution, and if the president of the National Assembly is capable to organize a vote, an election, then we would follow that process. But you know, even though the constitution exists and has that clear guideline, there have been really internal struggles and internal competitions, joking within the ruling party, who would take over, you know, in case anything happens to Biya. So people are positioning themselves in any way they can to step in. I think the opposition to in Cameroon is beginning to see this election as an opportunity for change. A lot of course. I think every Cameroonian is asking them to unite. You have to unite. There is no way you have elections without forming a solid coalition. And I think they're beginning to listen to that. I've seen a few statements here and there that they're thinking about a possible coalition, but that has not happened. So all of that is put Cameroon in a difficult position. But we will see. October is 4 months from now.
So there are two things. So from what you said, and that again could look come to the peculiarity of democracy in Africa, and elections, which I'm also a critic of the adoption of liberal multi-party kind of election system in Nigeria, which I'm currently kind of like researching and been writing on. But if we just look at our face value and look at how the institutions have been captured by the right institutions that can either guarantee the fair and free elections, like the ELECAM, or the ones that can intervene to when there's like disputes, like Riley said, Maurice disputed in 2018, like the judiciary. So that means there has to be some sort of, regardless of the future of regardless where that post, where there has to be some form of reforms, institutional reforms in these places. So even the coalition that stands that could be a key to challenging this is also, like you said, is declared illegal according to the constitution. So it doesn't, the constitution itself is a problem, could be a sham. So if the whole constitution itself restricts people or excludes them, is exclusion, excludes them, where should that change come from? Shouldn't it come from changing those institutions first? And if that's the case, what has been done in the past towards changing those inhibitive, whatever, within these institutions?
Yeah, that is a very, very interesting question. A lot of Cameroonians have been calling for key reforms. If you remember in 2018, after the elections, which Maurice Kamto claimed he won, it's not enough to say he won or he did not win. But he has been calling for really, really, really serious electoral reforms. Whoever becomes the next president of Cameroon, I think one of the first things they have to do is to revise the Cameroon constitution to improve a lot of things. First of all, you have to depoliticize the appointment in those key positions. The leader of the Constitutional Council is a BA appointee. The leader of the leaders of ELECAM are appointed by BA, or they are members of the CPDM somehow. We have to revise those things. And I think, you're from Nigeria. I think one of the things that the civil society and other groups working on electoral reform in Nigeria now, they're really pushing to stop disappointment of the chairman of INEC, right? He could be elected or something. So we have to depoliticize that and, find other ways to make these institutions to be very, very independent. I'm sure you've been following in recent times. There's been a lot of crackdown on civil society, on the media, institutions in the country. We have Cameroonians to be able to allow independent civil society to operate, whether it's to observe elections, or to educate citizens about their civic responsibilities, or to create a space for them to participate. It has to be, there has to be that space for civil society to operate. It's also important to enhance transparency in the vote counting. People, and that's one of the reasons that people don't feel like participating. If I go to vote and I'm not sure that my vote will count, why should I do it? So there has to be a clear space, where an open space where people can participate. And the judicial institutions, all of these have to be independent institutions that can, neutrally or objectively handle electoral disputes if they happen. It's a key, some of the key changes that are needed in Cameroon to guarantee a really free democratic space and process.
Very interesting. There's so we look at how has Paul Biya been able, one man has been able to stay in power for this long? And then this man also operates within the international community, I think. So again, you look at, and that's what I say, one of my criticism of democracy, and we know democracy has been in decline as well. We see what's going on in America where you are. There's not much difference. We can't say there's much difference between, the kind of authoritarian tendencies that we see in Western nations compared. So that kind of like my bolster, authoritarian leaders in Africa. So I guess my question is, I want to go to the external partners now, external international community, basically looking at the West for now. I'll come back to Russia. So if you look at the West, if I look at France, for instance, because I know last time there was a question of where is Paul Biya? Paul Biya was chilling in France, I guess, chilling in Paris. So we look at, what role have they played, France and all these Western nations, United States, in either directly or indirectly sustaining the authoritarian regime, and why would they, what would be the interest? Is it from a place of stability, which stability in itself is also a questionable concept idea?
Yeah. When you talk about, that's a very interesting one today. When you talk about a stability, or when we talk about peace, for example, you know, about positive and negative peace, right? Because, you know, positive peace is when institutions are working, people are able to participate in every process of the country. But when you talk about negative peace, which is just the absence of war, or you have all these structural issues, you know, that are destroying the very fabric of the country. So what the West has been able to do, of course, France, for example, has a very strong ties with Cameroon politically and economically, and for them, I think it's to the advantage to maintain that negative peace, that stability, so that they can continue to reap from the system. Of course, you know, in 2022, Macron was in Cameroon, and a question was asked to him about the future of Cameroon. And you know, he was very careful with his response, and it was like, it's up to Cameroonians to decide, you know. That could mean many things. It could also mean the guy is, you know, hedging his bets for whoever comes in, to maintain the relationship and continue to benefit from whatever he's benefiting from Cameroon, especially at this time where France is being kicked out across the West Africa. So he wants to be able to stay somewhere. But, you know, he would definitely call, oh, we want reforms, but it's up to Cameroonians to decide. For the U.S., and again, you know, Cameroon has different kinds of relationship with these people. Of course, in the Sahel, in that part of Africa where you see a lot of insurgency, terrorist groups, for example, in the Lake Chad Basin. Cameroon has military ties with all of these countries, and Cameroon is a key partner in that space. So these countries are also being careful how they want to be hard on Cameroon. Of course, they would say you have to do some reforms you have to improve your democracy. But you know, that is tampered by the relationship they have, you know, in dealing with Boko Haram and other terrorist groups. But if you recall, in 2019, the US had cut some of its support to Cameroon, military support to Cameroon, because of the atrocities, you know, in the Northwest and Southwest, the ongoing over there. So these countries, they have a key role to play, but as you're following, for the US, for example, we have a different dynamic now. We have a leadership in the US that don't really care about democracy. I don't think they have any major role to play now, you know, but apart from the main leaders, there's still people within the administration that care, and as the elections are coming up, we'll probably see statements, you know, we'll probably see a few comments here and there advocating for reforms or free and credible elections that allows everyone to participate on the level playing field. But it's a very it's a dicey situation. It's a future.
As the US and other Western countries, France in particular, have been kicked out from West Africa, another Francophone country, we see Russia influence, and I think there's I've read somewhere that there's a Russia disinformation machinery based in Douala.
Yes,
that also supports stability in the sense which is like, you know, the status quo. So what is, how does Russia provide? Well, if you're looking at the narrative of Russia in the Sahel, mm-hmm. as a champion of liberation from former colonial powers, mm-hmm. but that seems to be like a different narrative in the Cameroonian case. So I guess the question is, what role is Russia playing? Or does it, in the Cameroonian case, does it have a big role that it's playing?
As you mentioned, there's Afrique Media, which is a Russian media outlet that's headquartered in Douala, the economic capital of Cameroon. And from what I have been able to gather, I think the Russians are using this outlet to support stability, support BSD in power. I mean, I'm not sure why they're really doing this, but about this geopolitics, Russia is trying to gain influence in Africa. Russia is competing with the West, in Africa. I'm not sure if that is the main reason they are doing that. But I mean, even in the Sahel, and what you mentioned with the Russia coming in, it's challenging to tell, but when you want to be objective, sometimes you're like, okay, many of these countries got their independence in the 1960s, but they are not really, really, really independent. There is neo-colonialism somehow. If you look at, for example, a lot of the former French colonies, they pay what they call colonial taxes. Still have the first right of refusal when it comes to exploiting resources in those countries. So I think young people are beginning to think, then where is the independence? And worst of all, there have been not really improvement in development for Africa. Just infrastructure alone. If you look at Cameroon, the road network is horrible. And I keep asking myself that, look, for 42 years, if Biya was only constructing one road per year, the whole country would be connected by roads. People would farm their crops. They would move, take them to the market without any problem. And nobody would even care if they stayed there for 50 years. The kind of that's what we see in Rwanda, although people may say Kagame is a dictator, but he has improved the economic lives of the people. And the cave, he stays there for 30 years because their lives are moving forward, right? But we have not seen that kind of improvement, in Cameroon or in other French colonies. In Africa. And so people are beginning to think, okay, maybe we should try another option. And if Russia is willing to come in and help, why not give them the chance? Of course, we know Russia might also have its own intent.
Of course.
They want to sell weapons, they want to tap into resources, But people are looking at what really benefits them. Let me tell you something. Last year or so, I was in Sierra Leone. I had the opportunity of going up north to Makeni. And, driving up there, we passed through a very, very beautiful toll gate. And it was constructed by the Russians. And I was asking the driver, what do you think? Yeah, I was asking the driver, what do you think? The toll gates we have in the West Cameroon. There's one up there going up to Makeni. I was asking the driver, what do you think? He was like, you see this road built by the Russians? It's very, very useful to us. We can go to our farms, crops don't get rotten in the market. That's important to us. The West can say, it's a poor quality road. And what he told me was, if you have headache today, what you do is first to get a paracetamol to quell it down and then figure out what is really wrong with you. Let us enjoy the roads for now. If it gets bad in 5 years,
Yeah, I do agree with you. It's but I'm quite surprised there as well, because I would think more it's China that is more doing the Belt and Road thing and infrastructure. I didn't know Russia is also kind of like getting involved in this kind of.
I mean, yeah. If I remember, if I remember correctly, I think they mentioned it was Russia. Or it could be Chinese, but I think they mentioned Russia.
Yeah, this is. I'm quite surprised, because Russia has been more military kind of like cooperation, not necessarily infrastructure and economies. But that's the first. But like you rightly said, in my study as well, I've been looking at models that would use, and people have been looking at the Paul Kagame model, where you're looking at, anyways, if you look at democracy, people have linked it to development, and if it's not giving development, then they say what is the point? But if you're not looking at some kind of authoritarian democracy that is giving, you might say, okay, maybe this is a model to look at. But like you rightly said, in Cameroon, it's authoritarian, and then there's nothing, just no dividends. So it's very, very sad. But let me come to the, because we're coming to the last question now, because of the time. Let me ask this. So you mentioned in the Northwest and Southwest, we know the Ambazonian, the secession. I also know in the North, we know the Boko Haram and other thing that Cameroon is dealing with. Mm-hmm. So in what will all of this look like? How will it affect these very, very sensitive issues in Cameroon? Look, I guess the overall question is, what's going to be the impact of election on the security and development of Cameroon, looking at these key indicators, the secession in the North by the Anglophone speaking country, and then the Boko Haram, the insurgencies, and all of that? Let's end with that.
Yeah, that is a good question. To start with, in the Northwest and the Southwest, of course, I'm sure you know the background, but mm-hmm. that was started peacefully by teachers and lawyers that wanted reforms in the educational and the judicial sectors, quickly morphed into an armed conflict because of the heavy-handedness of the government. But as far as the election is concerned, in 2018, even before that, we have a separatist movement now, after the heavy crackdown by the government, it became a separatist movement, and we have groups that are really, really advocating for separation from the Francophone government. And what they've been able to do is really impose a boycott, imposing lockdowns. Last election, they did not support it, they did not participate and encourage people to boycott it. And we're beginning to see a similar rhetoric announced. But and the effect of that was in 2018 was that turnout was really poor for a number of reasons. I think turnout was just 10% in that region, in that part of the country. But this is a part of about 20 million people. Let me say 20% of the entire population of the country. So if these people are not able to participate, then that undermines the democratic process of the country. It makes the Anglophone Anglophones continue to feel marginalized, which is what started the conflict. So we must find ways to include, to make sure everyone is able to participate in these elections. As far as what happens after the elections and who wins, for me it's a tricky situation. We have people that feel like they have been marginalized for a very long time. They don't want to be part of the union anymore. So it would really take a leader that can really sit down and listen and be able to engage every key stakeholder in an inclusive dialogue process that has every option on the table to talk, to discuss, for discussion. Mm-hmm. The 2019 Grand National Dialogue that the government organized was a good move, but, you know, as we all know, it was very, very exclusionary. Some of the key stakeholders did not participate, and many feel that that was a sham of a process. So, you know, it's important to have someone that is willing to listen, that's willing to talk, you know, with all options on the table. Without that, and without effective participation from people in the Northwest and the Southwest, the process would be seen as incredible. As far as Boko Haram is concerned, up north, of course, that is always says a foreign conflict. It comes from Nigeria, but unfortunately, it has spilled into the different countries in the region. You know, Nigeria came from Nigeria, it's in Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. We have had, I think, there have been some success stories in trying to subdue Boko Haram. But you know, if you've been following, last year there was really a spike. Which means it's not eventually gone. And in the face of instability, in the face of insecurity, people cannot willfully or freely participate in any process. People are afraid of their lives, you know, and so they would want to you know, to be safe, you know. All of that is going to affect the elections somehow. But I know Cameroon being what it is, the elections will move forward. Whoever wins will win, but we only hope that whoever becomes the next president should be able to meaningfully engage and find ways to address some of these critical issues affecting the economy of the country.
Yeah, on that note, Jude, I'll share your optimism that whoever wins, because like I said, eventually one person must win.
Yeah.
You know, so whoever wins, we hope will advance, you know, the prosperity and of the people, because it's a shame that we've got more than 60% of the population are youth. And that is a very huge resources that has not been tapped into. But like I said, I share that hope, and all we can do is wait and see. Yeah. What happens. Well, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you for your very rich insights. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you,
hopefully maybe those that are that should listen to it and take heed to some of the advice that you've given.
That is my hope. Thank you so much for having me, and
all right,
I'm here anytime, reach out.
All right, thank you, Jude. Take care now.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you once again for tuning in this week. Help me as usual to thank our guest, Dr. Jude Mutai, who has joined me today to discuss the forthcoming elections in Cameroon and what lies ahead. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.